This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Today's guest has been with us a number of times before, helping us understand how criminal prosecutions can go awry. His previous book, Convicting the Innocent, is required reading for any who seek to understand how the justice system too often mistreats the poor and poorly represented. His newest work, The Flip Side. It unveils a legal system struggling to cope with criminality from the awesomely powerful. This book documents how huge corporations can break the law and then simply be told, don't do it again. Well, that might be a slight overstatement, but this new book, Too Big to Jail, goes into remarkable detail. At the same time, author Brandon Garrett is creating a public access database that might just help tip the scales of justice back toward balance. Want to hear more? You will, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. When a huge corporation breaks the law, how should it be dealt with? Is rehabilitation, in essence, asking the company to change its ways, an appropriate strategy? Is something else more appropriate or even workable? Those are some of the questions we'll be addressing this hour. And if you've got a perspective to share or even a related question of your own to offer, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. We are coming to you today from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, but our phone number is the same as always. And in all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. The book is titled Too Big to Jail, How Prosecutors Compromise with Corporations. Its author, legal scholar and University of Virginia Law School professor Brandon Garrett is our guest. Brandon, it is so great to have you back on the Inside Airwaves.
It is so great to be back.
Well, I guess the first obvious question is what do you hope people are going to get out of this book?
Well, I don't think most of us are even familiar with what happens when a corporation of all things gets prosecuted. I know I absolutely had no knowledge of this before I started doing this research 6 or 7 years ago. The idea that a corporation could be a criminal just seems weird to most criminal lawyers, much less, you know, members of the public. You don't see corporations on the stand when you watch Law & Order, right? It's just, it's not a concept that is really out there, except more recently. You know, I was telling you off air that when I thought of the title Too Big to Jail, I thought it was a really clever play off of the concept of too big to fail, the concern that the banks might be thought of as so crucial to our economy that they would take on risks and they know that the government's going to bail them out. But, you know, 2 years ago, I thought this was an original twist to call the book Too Big to Jail to convey the concept of how hard it is to hold a company accountable. Over these last couple of years, the phrase too big to jail has been repeated by everyone from senators to judges to journalists.
And your book hadn't come out yet.
No, but I think there's an increased public concern, particularly after the financial crisis, that companies are above the law. They're not being held accountable for things that are causing enormous social harm, including potentially bringing the economy to its heels, but it's everything from corporate crimes related to the environment, the BP spill, to foreign bribery, corruption around the world. Tomorrow, the BNP Paribas, the French bank, will be sentenced for violating sanctions, sending money to Sudan and Burma. And so there are all sorts of corporate crimes. And I think that people are becoming much more aware that corporate crime is really damaging. It can mean lost lives, like in the Gulf explosion or the Massey coal disaster. It can mean terrible harm to the economy or to our confidence in the financial system. It can mean corruption, money laundering. And then there's this question, a company doesn't exist, even if it's a legal person. How do you hold a company accountable? You can't put it in jail. You literally can't. You can't give it the electric chair or a firing squad. There are people in the company that committed crimes. What do prosecutors think about when the target is the company?
Is the equivalent of giving a company the electric chair, prosecuting it to the extent of putting it out of business?
There are two ways, actually. There actually is a corporate death penalty in the United States sentencing guidelines, and that involves just fining the company to death, seizing all of its assets, to compensate victims or to pay a fine. So, and it's rarely used, actually. There's a separate way a company can be effectively put out of business. And early on in my book, I tell the story of the Arthur Andersen prosecution, where the company was convicted, although the conviction was later reversed on appeal, for obstructing justice, destroying, shredding tons and tons of documents relating to its work with Enron.
So let's back up a little bit, because actually I wanted to ask you in detail about Arthur Andersen.
Yeah, yeah.
And as long as you've brought that up. Not everybody remembers this case. Not everybody even necessarily knows what
Arthur financial
Andersen
crisis
was.
Ago, right?
Yeah. So this was back in the 1990s. Arthur Andersen was one huge worldwide accounting firm, one of the Big Five.
The Big Five, and it was destroyed by the prosecution, but not because of the fine it paid. It wasn't fined to death. The fine was $500,000. They would have paid that in a heartbeat.
Tell some of the backstory. It was actually the conviction wasn't until the early 2000s, was it? But their crimes were committed in the 1990s.
So Enron had all sorts of fancy accounting that it was doing. And like many companies, when they face harder and harder financial times, they didn't want to come clean with their shareholders right away, and they were hoping to disguise the true extent of their precarious financial situation. And that's sort of the classic situation in which you might start to see securities fraud and accounting gimmicks, where they want to sort of keep the losses off books. They're sort of hoping that maybe they can figure something out in the meantime, if they can just buy some more time by disguising the fact that the company is experiencing a terrible financial situation.
And as you tell the story in your book, Brandon Garrett, the book Too Big to Jail, Arthur Andersen was the accounting firm keeping the books or watching the books or supposedly auditing Enron's practices.
And they had a big, big, highly profitable group of accountants doing it.
So they were making lots of money.
It was one of their top clients, the partner who headed this group. I talk a little bit about him because he eventually confesses to having committed obstruction of justice, and he's sort of the star witness in the case.
So when it comes to a point where people at Arthur Andersen begin to realize that there's a problem with Enron and begin to realize that that means that they, Arthur Andersen, are likely to be investigated, there seems to be a kind of wink, 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 nod, nod strategy for telling their employees how to proceed.
I said the word panic, even outright panic. They flipped out because they knew they were in serious trouble. Enron had announced a $1 billion misstatement of its earnings. That's a big difference between the earnings they reported and the actual earnings. And that could, you know, that's a big accounting error. And,
but when a company knows that, like Arthur Andersen, that forces of law, whether it's the SEC or federal prosecutors, are likely to come knocking at your door, you're not supposed to do anything that could be taken as destroying evidence. So Arthur Andersen managers did not tell their employees directly to start shredding documents and destroying evidence that could be used against them. They did something else.
They did something else. And this is it's such a great illustration of corporate culture and the complexity of corporations and how hard it is to pinpoint responsibility. The lawyers, it all starts with the lawyers. I'm a law professor. The lawyer sent out an email saying, make sure you tell everyone about our document retention policy, something that no one had ever heard of before. No one had paid attention to the document retention policy. And then they held big company-wide meetings. Well, not company-wide, but the whole very large group that was working on Enron-related stuff. Everyone must listen to this. Very careful. Big meeting. Everyone present. All the partners. All the leadership. Everyone's kind of like, what is going on? Hear about the document retention policy. And no one left that meeting, I don't think, thinking, oh, you know, our files, we need to make sure everything's nicely organized so we could find stuff. It was more
which
like,
is, in essence, what the policy says.
Don't keep duplicate policies. You know, if there's stuff you're not working anymore, you know, throw that stuff out. You don't need to keep unnecessary documents in your office.
But having big meetings about this policy was a way of actually giving a message to your employees that they got very clearly. What was that message?
Well, the prosecutors, this case went to trial, and it's the corporate trial of the century. Corporations rarely take their case to trial. Prosecutors could show that there's this enormous spike in deliveries to their shredding service. All of a sudden, you know, entire dumpsters full of documents were leaving their offices in Houston, like, you know, around the clock, just a huge spike in the pounds and pounds, the thousands of pounds of documents that were being carted off. And, you know, this isn't just Arthur Anderson, you know, freaking out. Obviously, you know, thousands of people all around the country lost their life savings because of what happened at Enron. That paper trail was crucial to the entire public, to public accountability, what was going on at Enron. And they weren't just sort of passively reviewing the books at Enron. They had sort of pioneered this strategy to sort of become like a management consultant company and do sort of on-site work at Enron. They were deeply embedded in Enron. And so
what ended up happening,
and we'll never know what was in those documents,
is that millions of documents were destroyed by the employees of Arthur Anderson that would have been crucial not only for understanding what happened at Enron, but also crucial for seeing to what degree Arthur Anderson did or did not break many laws.
Now, the day that the Securities and Exchange Commission sent an official subpoena saying, give us the documents, they immediately sent an order around, okay, stop the shredding. Stop the shredding now. But then the question was, okay, but didn't they know weeks before that the SEC was opening up an investigation, that they were interested, that this was a serious issue that the government was going to be poring over in detail? Did they just destroy all these documents because they knew that the government was coming? And that's what the whole case was about. It was about destruction of justice. It wasn't about the accounting work that they did.
Obstruction of justice. Right. And so, Brandon Garrett, one of the reasons that I'm asking you to go in detail to this story that's in the very earliest part of your new book, Too Big to Jail, is not only is it fascinating in itself, but it sort of becomes a cautionary tale and a touchstone for what prosecutors think they should or shouldn't do in the future that relates to the situation that we're in today.
Yeah, and so Arthur Anderson risked a trial. They decided to take this case to trial, which, you know, very few criminal defendants do that, much less companies. They're trying to put a human face on the company. Are you going to destroy this company with tens of thousands of employees because of what a few rogue employees did? Arthur Anderson stands for ethics and accounting, and you're going to tar and feather this company and destroy it, this innocent company? It was an incredibly aggressive defense. And why was it a life and death matter? Well, if a company is convicted of a federal crime, of a felony, the Securities and Exchange Commission can terminate its ability to do accounting work for publicly listed, public companies listed on the stock exchanges.
Which was most of Arthur Anderson's work.
Right. And so as a big five accounting company, that's why you hire a really, really big accounting company, because they have the ability and the resources to do work for the biggest companies.
So if Arthur Anderson gets convicted of obstruction of justice, it knows that the SEC, in essence, is going to pull its license to operate, and it's, in essence, going to get the equivalent of a death penalty.
And it's so interesting that it's the civil consequence. People talk about the collateral consequences of convictions, that, you know, you may lose the ability to vote or to serve on juries. It's harder to get a job if you're convicted. It's literally impossible to go on as an operating company in some industries, if it's a regulated industry, if you get convicted of a crime. And so it's not the fine, it's not the criminal punishment itself, but it's the civil collateral consequence. That's what ended up destroying Arthur Anderson.
Because it was convicted, even though it was later, that conviction overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. By that time, it was too late. Arthur Anderson had all but gone out of business. Tens of thousands of employees lost their jobs. And as you tell in your new book, that relates to what we're going to be talking about next, how prosecutors today try to deal with huge corporations who appear to be lawbreakers. Brandon Garrett is a named professor at the University of Virginia Law School and author of the new book, Too Big to Jail, How Prosecutors Compromise with Corporations. This is Virginia Insight. We're going to continue this conversation in just a bit more than 1 minute. Brandon Garrett's previous book was titled Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. His newest book examines a different arena where our justice system can go wrong in failing to prosecute huge corporations that break the law. That newest book is titled Too Big to Jail. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you want to talk with Brandon Garrett, we do have phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight.
Maybe we should welcome corporate callers as well. They may have very different views about what we're talking about.
So the Arthur Andersen story that I asked you to go into detail a few minutes ago, Brandon, leads to something really important that really is the basis of your book. And that's how prosecutors later decided to approach dealing with corporations when they seem to be engaging in wanton lawbreaking. So tell us about this newer strategy.
So prosecutors had to regroup after Arthur Andersen. The company dissolves. Everyone is shocked that this Big Five accounting firm was basically destroyed, even if the obstruction of justice that occurred was terrible. And Arthur Andersen may have fallen apart anyway. It was under investigation for so many major problems involving accounting that it was doing. And people may not have wanted to use them as accountants anyway. But prosecutors were concerned, and maybe rightly so, that they shouldn't just be destroying companies. They want to punish the people who did something wrong, and they want to hurt the company and make sure it doesn't do it again. What they did in 2003, they issued a new set of guidelines. They're not laws. They don't have to follow them, but optional guidelines. But they said, federal prosecutors, you need to think differently about prosecuting corporations. It was popularly called the Thompson Memo after the Deputy Attorney General who wrote it. And it was actually a rewrite of a memo that Eric Holder wrote when he was Deputy Attorney General in the Clinton administration in the late 90s. And what it said was, you shouldn't always prosecute a corporation. Sometimes if it's just individuals who really did something wrong, just prosecute the individuals. And obviously, there are thousands of individual people prosecuted for fraud or white-collar offenses every year in the U.S., and there's no company that's punished along with them. It's less than 200 cases a year where a company is targeted. And so how do you decide which are the cases where it's worth going after the company? Well, they say, well, was it high-up officials at the company that did it? Did the company have a record of misconduct in the past? Did it seem like they tolerated misconduct? Or on the flip side, is the company doing things to try to make sure this doesn't happen again? Do they have good compliance? And are there these collateral consequences? Would a conviction destroy the company, hurt innocent shareholders, hurt consumers, hurt clients? And if so, maybe you don't try to convict the company. Maybe you offer it a more lenient alternative, which we'll have to explain. It's a sort of a juvenile justice approach to corporate crime.
The rehabilitation strategy.
Yeah, so something new came about. It wasn't totally new. There were about a dozen of these in the 1990s that we've been able to find. There's this database, one of two databases that I keep on the University of Virginia Law Library website. And I understand, Tom, that you have it posted on Virginia Insight so people can look at it. But some of the most interesting settlements with corporations starting in 2003 when this policy change happened involved not convictions of companies. In the past, if a company committed a crime, you convict it, just like Arthur Andersen got convicted. They decided to do these deferred and non-prosecution agreements.
Meaning, that's important. So let me, that's two different things.
Two different things.
Deferred prosecution and a non-prosecution agreement.
Yeah,
and in both cases, what we're talking about is what is going to anger some people listening, is that companies basically getting almost a pass as long as they promise to change their behavior.
It's an unusual kind of pass, but a non-prosecution is, it's not a complete pass, right? A real non-prosecution is, oh, we're not prosecuting you, you're innocent. That's the kind of pass, that wouldn't normally even be made public. Prosecutors shouldn't hurt someone's reputation and say, oh yeah, we thought about prosecuting you, but nah, not so much. A non-prosecution agreement is a little different. They say, okay, company, you have to admit your crime. You accept responsibility. You're going to pay a fine. You're going to make changes to make sure this doesn't happen again. But if you do all those things, we won't even file a thing in court. There will be no indictment. There will be no conviction. This case will never see a courtroom after 2 years or 3 years, assuming you follow all these terms of the agreement, you cooperate with us, you do all this stuff, you pay the fine. It'll be
so
like,
that's a non-prosecution agreement.
It's a non-prosecution
that
agreement.
The company signs off on, agrees to all the terms. And then a deferred prosecution is a little bit different but somehow similar?
Pretty similar because it's mostly out of court. It's not like a plea agreement where there's a conviction entered in front of a judge. A deferred prosecution agreement, sometimes used for first-time drug offenders or for juveniles, and the idea is we're going to file a case in court, but just initially file it in court. We'll then put it on ice. We will agree to waive all the speedy trial stuff because normally you can't just let a case sit around on a judge's docket. So we'll waive speedy trial and we'll agree to let the case sit there for 2 or 3 years. And if you pay the fine, you cooperate, you show good conduct, then at the end of the 2 or 3 years, we will dismiss the case. The judge will never have any reason to do anything with it. The case is over. It's gone. No record, no conviction. You're all clear.
So basically, it's sort of like being on a kind of probation where the judge says to the juvenile first-time offender, you keep your nose clean for the next 2 years and this goes completely away, you get in trouble again and you're going to have big problems.
Yeah.
So that's the deferred prosecution approach to dealing with corporate law breaking.
And we saw an explosion in that after Arthur Andersen.
How well are those two strategies working?
So first, the explosion. It's not just that we've seen more of these deferred and non-prosecution agreements. There now have been over 300 of them. That's still not, 200 or so companies are prosecuted every year. So most companies don't get these.
But what's
really interesting is the biggest companies, the public companies, disproportionately.
The Fortune 500.
Yeah. So, well more than half of the public companies get these deferred and non-prosecution agreements. Until recently, banks always received non-prosecution agreements. Then there were a couple deferred prosecution agreements. The first bank convictions were just in this last year, and prosecutors announced that as a noteworthy change. And so you started to see the most serious corporate crimes getting the most lenient treatment. And that struck me as just backwards.
And one of the other things that I got from your book, Brandon Garrett, Too Big to Jail, is that not all the records of what's going on in these types of new approaches to dealing with corporate lawbreaking are actually accessible to the public.
No.
So that although you're talking about 200 or 300 cases over the past few years, there could be a lot more that simply haven't been revealed.
Well, we think we have a pretty exhaustive collection. The deferred prosecution agreements are filed in court, and so those are easier to find. I started working on this in part because there is some data on what happens when companies are convicted, because the U.S. Sentencing Commission has information on companies that are sentenced. But these companies that get deferred and non-prosecution agreements, there's no sentence. And so there was no information on what was happening in these really important corporate crimes. And so I started collecting them like a pack rat.
But for a non-prosecution agreement, which is not filed in court, there could be some of those going on that there are no public records for.
And we know that there are some. And obviously that's the benefit of doing it in that way. A non-prosecution agreement, a company keeps it out of the public eye. It's not filed in court. It's less official.
I want to also get into some detail about some of the specific companies and some of what you've discovered has happened or hasn't happened, and when this strategy is working and when it's not.
But
we're starting to get phone calls now.
I should mention the UVA has sued. Our First Amendment clinic has sued to unseal some of these non-prosecution agreements.
Oh, good. So we can get to some detail on that.
Yeah.
But for anybody who's just joined us, let me mention that Brandon Garrett is our guest. He's a named professor at the University of Virginia Law School and author of the new book, Too Big to Jail: How Prosecutors Compromise with Corporations. If you want to talk to him, we've got phone lines open at 888-967-2825. Easy to remember is 888-WMRA Talk. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and we're going next, I believe, to Amherst Phil, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment. And Phil, if you have your radio turned on,
we need you to.
Hello, this is Phil in Amherst. I'm really enjoying this program. I'm a listener generally. I'm just really very disappointed that we don't have a Teddy Roosevelt around regularly to knock some of these people's heads. I think we have to prosecute the offenders to the max, and just because somebody above wasn't directly doing it, that's where the buck stops, I think we need to say. And maybe they can pay for psychological testing of anyone who's working in such a responsible position. And then that's a good place to put the bonuses that some other people are enjoying so well. But I think that that might help. And maybe we should – I know I've heard some people, they seem to have a different calendar than mine. We need to remind them that the Anderson issue came up while Bush was in the White House. It's a Bush item. Obama didn't have anything to do with it. That would be my comment.
Yeah. Although the current approach towards corporate prosecutions, it crosses administrations. And
yes, it can.
Well, hold on, if you would, Phil. In terms of Phil's first,
let's talk about the higher ups.
Yeah, okay.
So, Phil, you're absolutely right. You know, I talk in the book about how rare it is for the highest level officials to ever be held accountable in these corporate crime cases. There have been less than a couple of dozen CEOs prosecuted. When the companies have absolutely admitted that they committed crimes, they get these deferred and non-prosecution agreements. Only a little more than a third of the time are any employees charged, but it's quite rare for the top officials, CEOs, CFOs, to be charged. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens. The former CEO of Massey Coal was just charged a couple of weeks ago, and some of the lower-level employees, kind of like what you just described, said that the pressure was coming from the boss, from the top, to ignore safety rules in the mine, which then exploded. But then the question will be, can they connect the dots? Can they show that the CEO was really responsible? Or can the CEO say, as often happens in these trials, the sort of the ostrich defense, my head was in the sand, I was blind to what was going on below, I only give general orders to improve profits and things like that, but I didn't know that any crimes were being committed, it's not my fault. That's how it normally goes, and it's going to be a complicated trial if it goes to trial.
Well, in your book, Brandon Garrett, Too Big to Jail, it seems to me that one of the things you document are those cases where prosecutors are looking at alleged lawbreaking at a corporation and making decisions about how to approach, what strategy to use, whether to try to take them to trial or use a deferred prosecution agreement or a non-prosecution agreement. One of the questions they ask is, does this company seem to have a culture of lawbreaking? And would one of these so-called rehabilitation strategies help change the culture? So Phil's comment is you catch them in significant lawbreaking. If you had Teddy Roosevelt around, you'd be knocking heads. What's your response to that?
It's not common to try to knock heads. And plenty of people remember the days, you know, when Rudy Giuliani was U.S. attorney and he would purposely have Wall Street executives do perp walks with the cameras to publicly embarrass them for insider trading and the like. You know, I don't know that we want to humiliate any kind of criminal, whether it's white collar or street criminal. But in these cases, it's typically the situation where you don't have any individuals charged and you worry that the company is turning into a scapegoat. The company can pay a fine. Hopefully the company makes good changes. But, you know, normally we want individual people to be held accountable for crimes. And these are some of the most serious crimes imaginable in terms of their economic impact and the like. You also worry about whether the right people in the company are being held accountable. Even if some heads are being knocked, is it the company who's throwing some underlings under the bus? Are prosecutors really getting to the bottom of who did what in a big organization? These cases are incredibly challenging, and they really require the resources of a very, very different type. You need not just one Teddy Roosevelt, but you need big offices of hundreds of little Teddy Roosevelts working for the Teddy Roosevelt, because these companies can hire entire law firms in their defense.
Phil, thank you so very much for joining us here on Virginia Insight. Law professor Brandon Garrett is our guest. Actually, at the University of Virginia Law School, his official title is the Roy L. and Rosamond Woodruff Morgan Professor of Law, just in case you wanted to know. The title of Professor Garrett's newest book, Too Big to Jail, How Prosecutors Compromise with Corporations. If you want to talk with Mr. Garrett, we've got more phone lines open at 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have this on our Facebook page from Lauren, who says, if our justice system is so interested in rehabilitation for millionaires and billionaires, why is that approach not being used for the drug addicted and mentally ill who make up such a large part of America's prison population? Brandon Garrett, as somebody who spent most of his career in civil rights law working with the poor, I would imagine that Lauren's singing to the choir there.
Well, obviously, yeah, my first book is about indigent defendants, poor people who were wrongly convicted, they were innocent even, and spent enormous amounts of time in prison. And one of the reasons I started doing this work was that I think, you know, we should judge our criminal justice system both by how it treats the least privileged offenders and how it treats the most privileged offenders. You can't get much more privileged than a major corporation which has resources that no individual criminal defendant has. And prosecutors are absolutely, as we've started to describe on the show, they try to rehabilitate companies to make them better, to prevent future crimes. We don't do that so much with individual people. It's more lock them in jail and throw away the key. It's stringent criminal sentences. We've started to see a thaw, but the approach since particularly the 70s is we punish. We want retribution. We want people in jail for crimes that they committed. We don't want to make them better people. We don't want to have prison libraries and job training. We're not like, you know, Western Europe where people are in prison as a transition to being more productive members of society. You know, we don't spend money on higher education for people not in prison. We just want to build more prisons and lock them up. And that's you know, there is no deferred prosecution program, say, for nonviolent first-time offenders.
Why?
In our federal system. You know, Eric Holder gave some speeches recently saying, you know, we have some very small pilot programs. Maybe we should start thinking about more alternatives to prison in the federal criminal system. So maybe we should experiment with some more of that. That's not true for corporations. It's not just an experiment. It's, you know, official policy that across the board, you think about doing these deferred and non-prosecution agreements with
well,
companies.
We haven't talked in too much detail yet about these rehabilitation strategies, and I hope to after we get to this break. But let me just ask you this, Brandon Garrett. Do you have any hope in all this research you've done recently about these strategies for the Hughes corporations that are based on rehabilitation rather than prosecution, that the whole mindset of rehabilitation might filter down to individual crimes with first offenders that Lauren seems to be talking about, especially if they're mentally ill or they have a drug addiction problem?
I hope so. Some of the states are experimenting with that more, and that's a really good sign.
Phone number 888-WMRA-TALK in all numbers works out to be 888-967-2825. If you want to join the conversation here on Virginia Insight. And we're going to be back in just a bit more than 1 minute. You're tuned to Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and I'm going through the pages here trying to find this quote. Oh, here it is. This is former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers. Part of what he wrote very recently in the Financial Times about the book we are discussing this hour with its author, Brandon Garrett. So from Larry Summers, quote, Garrett provides narratives of some of the major cases that keep the reader at the edge of his seat. Corporate criminals will always be with us. Our future considerations of what to do about them should draw on Brandon Garrett's important work. Must feel good to have a former U.S. Treasury Secretary give you that kind of accolade.
That was an enormous honor, just that he was willing to write a review of the book, much less say such kind things about it.
So tell us a little bit more about how these rehabilitation strategies with huge corporations work or don't work.
Well, one of the cases that I talk about in the very beginning of the book, and then I sort of tell the story in bits and pieces as you move along, is the case of a German multinational company called Siemens. And some of you may have Siemens coffee makers or home appliances, but they do all kinds of things. They're like General Electric.
One of the biggest corporations in the world.
Yeah, and like General Electric, they do things. They build dams. They build entire subway systems, telecommunication systems, major, major government projects. And in the 90s and before, in Germany, it was legal to pay bribes to foreign officials to get business. And so they had literally boxes of cash at their offices around the world, which they called, it was a German word for basically useful money. And it was very useful. They would pay, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars every year to get that contract to build a subway system in Brazil or whatever. And, you know, you're paying $10, $20 million to get a $100, $200, $300 million contract was a pretty good deal.
But where we jump forward is when that becomes illegal.
Yes, in the late 90s.
And they end up running afoul of U.S. law specifically.
And interestingly, these foreign bribery laws, we've had them in the U.S. since the 70s when it was discovered after Watergate that Nixon's men and companies were not only funneling money to Nixon, but they actually had accounts that they're using to bribe around the world. And foreign governments and companies had money coming into U.S. politics. We didn't like that either. So it was a post-Watergate law in the U.S. It was hardly ever enforced against companies until a big treaty was signed in the late 90s, making it a crime in lots of first world countries like Germany. But Siemens kept doing it. And I tell the story of this guy, the banker, Reinhard Sipacek, who's talked to the media some because he cooperated with the police in Munich, Germany. Basically, he said, you know, it was our job to pay the bribes. We'd organize the money. We'd put the euros in suitcases. You can fit a lot of euros in a small suitcase. We'd give it to sort of middlemen who would then make contact with the government official. And that was basically our way of doing business. We knew it was a crime. We knew it was wrong. But we knew that we couldn't really compete otherwise. And we figured if we ever got in trouble, there'd be an awful lot of us going up to the CEO who would end up playing cards in a huge jail cell. And so, you know, we were doing what we were told. It wasn't, you know, he was kind of like, you know, I wasn't making any particular profit from doing this. It was just the way of doing business at the company. And lo and behold, in 2006, the German police knock on his door and he says, I know what this is about. I've been expecting you. I start the book with that. It sounds like a James Bond movie or something like that. And he did know what it was about. And but what then happens is that for the next 3 years, up through 2009, the case is investigated in the U.S. And it's the U.S. prosecutors that take the lead. And Siemens spends over $1 billion on U.S. legal fees investigating its own bribery to turn itself in, which is totally remarkable that they... And they got enormous credit for that, too. They paid $800 million in fines in the U.S., but the fines could have been several times that. What prosecutors said is, we're giving you a huge discount on these fines, because not only because you've cooperated, but because of the sweeping rehabilitative changes that you've agreed to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And so that's where rehabilitation comes in.
So let's look at what you've just described, Brandon Garrett, in comparison to what you were telling us earlier in the hour. Prosecutors believe that they need a new approach to dealing with huge corporations because they don't necessarily want to so vigorously prosecute a corporation that they put it out of business and put tens of thousands of people out of work, like what happened with Arthur Andersen. They also have the reality that if they're extremely adversarial in a criminal court case with a huge corporation that can spend hundreds of millions of dollars on its legal defense, they may be outgunned, the prosecutors. And if you have a company that looks like it's willing to cooperate, even though it seemed to have a culture of lawbreaking, as you've described Siemens had when it came to paying these bribes, if the company is willing to cooperate, then maybe they're a good candidate for this new rehabilitation strategy approach. How does it work with Siemens?
Well, Siemens, it really does seem like a success story. It's hard to tell from the outside, but I actually talked a fair amount to some of the people on the inside, two of the corporate monitors in the case. And what happened was that Siemens agreed to do sweeping compliance reforms, and they agreed to hire these two outsiders, independent corporate monitors, One was Joseph Warren, a prominent lawyer at Gibson Dunn in Washington, D.C. Another was Dr. Theo Weigel, the former German finance minister, a very prominent figure in Germany. And they had an enormous team working for them. And so it wasn't just Siemens' word that, oh, yes, you know, we're hiring new people to make sure that we're not paying bribes anymore. They had these independent overseers. And Siemens did more.
That was part of the agreement with prosecutors, is that they had to clean up their act and they had to prove that this type of lawbreaking was no longer going on anywhere in their company.
And prosecutors, through these monitors, would be keeping watch for 4 years, so quite a bit of time. But, you know, it's a huge company. You can't just change it overnight. The company actually immediately, and you do not see this happen, particularly when U.S. companies are on the receiving end of a prosecution, do they feel so embarrassed that they feel like they need to change their entire leadership? People have complained that, you know, these Wall Street banks are getting prosecuted, nothing changes. Well, Siemens didn't go that way. They fired their CEO, the CFO, the head of compliance. 50 out of 100 of the top leadership positions were replaced. Basically, the entire leadership turns over. And again, you do not normally see that when a company gets prosecuted. But they felt like, we need to totally transform ourselves. This is terrible what we've been doing. We're going to turn over a completely new leaf. They gave the corporate monitor basically the front office when you walk into their headquarters to highlight just how important this person was. The monitor makes hundreds of recommendations in the first year. Every single one of them is followed. They create this enormous new compliance department, which is seen as a stepping stone to a better career at Siemens. It isn't sort of like a marginal type of thing.
So this rehabilitation strategy approach with this particular case seems to have worked. In your book, Brandon Garrett, Too Big to Jail, it seems to me that you found information about any number of cases where this type of prosecutorial or non-prosecution approach really didn't work.
No, it doesn't seem like most prosecution agreements or most companies take reform and compliance seriously in the way that Siemens did. Siemens even told the monitors, please stay for a couple more years. You're doing such great things to help us improve. That doesn't normally happen, obviously. Most of these agreements don't call for these detailed top-to-bottom reforms. Many of them just say some generic things like, okay, company, pay a fine and adopt some, you know, compliance practices. They don't say what the practices are or whether they should be tested. Most of these agreements do not have independent monitors checking up to make sure the company is actually following through. And how's a prosecutor supposed to check up with maybe, you know, a couple of lawyers assigned to a case? How are they supposed to check up on the operations of a big multinational company? And then, of course, you're still more worried about cases where, especially some of the Wall Street banks, they've been prosecuted multiple times within a short time span, sometimes for overlapping conduct. And if a company is a recidivist, although not technically because they were getting non-prosecution agreements all along, so there's no criminal record, but if they keep getting prosecuted again and again, clearly something isn't working. Clearly the agreements aren't rehabilitating the company.
I realize that this is a fairly new strategy. As you pointed out, Brandon, it only started a little bit more than 10 years ago. But it seems to me, Brandon, that I've also heard you say in the past that it's your impression after doing all the research that you did for this book that many prosecutors, maybe even the justice system in general in the U.S., is not taking this idea of rehabilitation all that seriously. So, one, am I remembering accurately what you have said about this? And two, if so, why are we not taking it seriously?
Well, if we really wanted to be strict about rehabilitation with the most serious corporate offenders, we would do what we do with individuals. We would put them on probation. Right? Siemens was convicted. It didn't get one of these deferred prosecution deals. And so if it wasn't following through with the monitoring and the compliance, it could be a violation of probation. They could be brought back for a new trial or for strict punishments. But when it's a deferred or non-prosecution agreement, rehabilitation is sort of more informally being overseen by a prosecutor. Some judges, I think, have sensibly recoiled against this idea. They've said, this deferred prosecution is filed in my courtroom. You're telling me that I can't be told what the status is? I want to know whether this company is really showing good conduct, because otherwise it shouldn't be given a break. I shouldn't let this case sit on my docket if the company really isn't showing good conduct. And so a few judges have recoiled at the idea that rehabilitation is just something that a prosecutor informally agrees to.
Is part of the problem, Brandon, that this strategy is new enough that the kinks really haven't been worked out yet? And maybe that you're hoping that your book is going to point out ways that it needs to be improved?
I hope so. We've seen over time some positive improvements. Some of the agreements more recently have a little bit more detail about what the compliance is supposed to be. But, you know, most of the time, prosecutors don't even demand that the company audit these new programs and compliance. And, you know, what's the company doing to make sure crime doesn't happen again? We all know that it's not enough to just say we have a new code of conduct at our corporation which says don't commit fraud. And we give a training to our employees every year where we explain that fraud is bad. Right, that's not going to be enough. If you have a culture where cutting corners is profitable and you get bonuses that way and employees are rewarded for sharp dealing, it's not going to change anything to make them sit through a one-hour training every year. And so if you're going to do more than that and you really want to be watching over and auditing the work that your employees do, well, how effective is it? Well, and it was interesting, there were hearings in Congress over these deferred prosecution agreements. I participated in two of them. Starting in 2009, and the GAO issued a report saying, why aren't there performance measures? Why aren't prosecutors assessing whether these corporate agreements are really working or not? And it was interesting. The response of the Department of Justice said, well, it's hard to think of performance measures, but we'll be sure to just, over time, just watch these things and see how they seem to be working, basically. That doesn't seem like something that should give us much confidence that there's careful study going into what the terms of these corporate prosecution agreements should be.
Brandon Garrett, I understand that in many of your public presentations since this book has come out, you have gotten one most frequent question. It may not be your favorite, but I've got to ask it as well. Why are more bankers not in jail?
Oh, I was hoping you were going to ask me what my favorite color was. That's the too big to jail question.
After the financial meltdown and the misbehavior from so many financial firms, you got to understand that a large part of the public is thinking, where's the prosecution of the people who did this?
Even more specifically, I've had people tell me, you don't know how many dinner parties I go to in Manhattan where the entire subject of dinner is why is Jamie Dimon specifically not in jail, or particular heads of particular banks. People know how close the world economy came to the brink. And they want to know, you know, if someone should be in jail for anything, shouldn't someone be in jail for that? And to make it even more troubling, you know, what I describe in this book is that many of those banks have themselves been prosecuted. They've entered these non-prosecution deals where they admit that crimes were committed, and yet no employees go to jail. And that sits even worse. We know that crimes were committed, and yet individual bankers were not punished. Now, most of those cases didn't have to do in any particular way with the causes of the financial crisis. The financial crisis fraud cases have been brought as civil cases, not criminal. And prosecutors have said we just weren't able to find enough evidence of intent related to all this complicated stuff with mortgage-backed securities. And that may not be true. If they had treated it like the Massey Cole case in West Virginia and started with some lower-level people and threatened them with prosecution, secured their cooperation, maybe they would have gathered evidence that, wait a minute, we knew that these mortgage-backed securities were junk and our supervisors told us to sell, 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 and they knew it. You know, maybe they could have built cases from the ground up.
So is part of the answer to the question, why are more of these miscreants not in jail, that we don't have the will to go up against such powerful people?
It certainly is resource intensive. Sometimes prosecutors try and they absolutely fail in these cases. There was the effort to target SAC Capital for insider trading, and the company itself pleaded guilty. A number of senior traders there either pleaded guilty or convicted at trials, but all along they were trying to go after the head of SEC Capital and show that he was the one really directing all this insider trader. They were never able to show it.
I'm so sorry we've gotten to where we've only got about 30 seconds left, and I have to ask, although you go into this in some detail in your book, what can you sum up about what you think needs to be done next with these new strategies for dealing with corporations that break the law?
Well, we absolutely need to insist that companies be convicted so that they have a criminal record. But we need to invest in going after the employees. To answer that question, why aren't the bankers or other in prison? If employees commit crimes, it's not a substitute to just fine the company. Now, we should still prosecute the company. The company could cooperate and help to make the case against the employees, but we absolutely need to do both.
And more public record of what is being done, being accessible to the public, has got to be a good thing. And you have these new databases that you've created that are now on University of Virginia Law Library websites. And we have links to those on the Virginia Insight page as well. Our guest has been Brandon Garrett, legal scholar, the Morgan Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, and author of the new book, Too Big to Jail: How Prosecutors Compromise with Corporations. Brandon, thank you so very much for
making time. Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you.
You can find podcasts of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you get to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Professor Garrett is doing. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay, Dan Easley, our technical director, associate producer, Bob Levicky. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell, Elliot Majerzik, and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.